Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here and Chad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. It's going to be 2 hours of the weekend show because Al is taking a little break this week. So in the second hour, we are going to replay some of the, I think, more important company updates that we recorded on this week. Because look, there's a lot of news coming out of the resource sector. Even as I know we're going through another painful correction. Companies are still doing stuff, and if you want to be buying stocks, you need to be doing your research right now. Chad and I are kicking off the show with Jayant Bhandari, private investor and consultant to a lot of the big money players within this sector. Jayant, we have to start with the precious metals. In full disclosure, we are recording this about halfway through the trading day on Thursday, and it's not a good day for precious metals investors. Gold is down about $40, sitting right around that $1,750 level. Silver is down over a dollar today, sitting right in that $22 level. Overall, Jayant, look, the sector, especially when it comes to the gold and silver prices, it's been relatively boring. Gold was stuck pretty much at that $1,800 level for about 3 months. Now we're getting a bit more of a sell-off, but still, the sector's been slow, the mood is pretty depressed, and stocks continue to get hit. What's your takeaway from, broadly, the weakness in the precious metal sector that we continue to see?
Well, Corey, I am euphoric right now, and I have always been euphoric when the stock prices fall so much. Gold has fallen by 2 or 3%. It's no big deal for me. I think gold does that all the time, but stock prices have fallen by, some of the prices that I'm looking at have fallen by 10, 15%. And that clearly is a place where I want to invest because that's where the easiest and best money is made. And I am always amused that people are fearful in this market when I'm actually euphoric, when you can actually do quite well by just not letting emotions take over your rational thinking.
Well, Jayant, when you see these kind of pressure squeezes and a lot of the sentiment gets so negative, but then some of these stocks, like we've even seen major sell-off by high single digits or double digits. Do you like to scale into positions during that time frame? Do you like to wait to see that the dust settles first? You know, how do you approach doing some bottom fishing in these kind of scenarios?
I don't think you can predict when the dust will settle because in retrospect, you can always think that you knew what was going to happen. But if you could actually see into the future, you would have corrected your actions based on the future. So a lot of analysis that people try to do about how market behaves is looking at curves in retrospect, but really you can't predict the future. When I see value, I basically want to go into it. Now, I do know that today is a depressed market, so all my buy prices have been reduced by 10% or so. And I know that one company did get filled this morning and more will get filled as the market comes to a close today. So yes, I do want to exploit the bearishness in the market, but the market can become more bearish tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. I'm not going to wait for that. I'm just going to exploit the 10-15% extra upside that I can get by buying those stocks today.
Okay, it does sound like you're also lowering some of your purchase prices too, right? So maybe even waiting for a little bit more weakness. Overall though, Jayant, look, the sector is pretty unloved right now. I wasn't able to go down to any of these recent conferences, whether it's Beaver Creek or Denver Gold due to some of the restrictions, but you were there. What can you tell us about your takeaways from those conferences and what the attendance was like, what the mood was like?
I am still in Colorado Springs, where Denver Gold Show ended yesterday afternoon, and it was pretty dead, actually. In most of the speeches, I saw no more than, let's say, 10 people in the auditorium. Usually, those halls are packed with standing-only space. So that much is the change that I have seen in Denver Gold Show. On the last day, yesterday afternoon, I probably saw maybe 5 to 10 people in totality walking around, the same 5 to 10 people. So there was not much of an audience at Denver Gold Show. And so was the case in Beaver Creek, although I think Beaver Creek had more people who are risk takers and who wanted to make sure they attended the conference. But it's still in the auditoriums of Beaver Creek Show. You would see often a completely empty hall. They would still give their speech because those speeches were telecast live, I think, and they were recorded. But it was quite a strange for speakers to be welcoming people when there was no one in the audience.
I bet that would be strange. Now, Giant, we have seen this environment before. I remember going to some of these conferences when it was dead. And unfortunately, that didn't necessarily mark the bottom because we had a prolonged period of sideways, boring trading in the sector. When do you start to get a little bit more worried that maybe the market won't bounce back as fast and maybe it will be unloved for a prolonged period of time?
Well, I actually don't worry. I make sure that I have at least 1 or 2 years worth of cash with me. And as long as the market is undervalued from my perspective, I go to sleep in peace. I have almost never worried about fall in share prices, except when I was in using margin. I have stopped using margin to buy stocks for now many years, and that has actually made it possible to get a good sleep and not worry when the stock prices fall. And I have actually almost always been able to benefit from these shocks that we see in the market. In fact, I can sometimes use up my cash and, you know, buy something today and sell the same thing for a 30 or 40% profit within the next week or two. So these are the kinds of markets that I like to benefit from rather than to lose in.
Yeah, sometimes it can make for very nice swing trades indeed, Giant. One other thing that catches my attention when people go to conferences is sometimes you get to have those good one-on-ones or discussion with management or chat at a bar, chat at a restaurant. Did you come away with any companies that caught your eye that you thought, hey, these may be some good ones? I'm sure you found some companies that looked interesting while you were there.
So I've been coming to Denver Gold Show for the last 15 years. I have been to every single Beaver Creek show, except for the first one. So yes, I have benefited hugely from coming to these conferences. Particularly the Beaver Creek show is extraordinarily good for me because I look at junior mining companies, and Jessica and Karen do an absolutely outstanding job of organizing that conference. I have in these 15 years never come back thinking there were so many opportunities in the market. I have in front of me at least 10 names that I want to, all new names actually, that I want to spend more time on over the next few days. So I'm going to be very busy for the next couple of weeks analyzing those companies, trying to understand them. And a lot of these names are actually surprisingly development stage companies, and they, at least on the first pass basis, look reasonably cheap to me.
So, Giant, what are some of the names? Can you share some of the companies that you chatted with that you think are interesting?
Let's look at a company called Moneta Gold. It's trading at $1.80. It's, I think, lowest in the last several months. And the funny thing is that they recently acquired Garrison Project from O3 Mining. And now they will be able to explore in between the two projects, and they will be able to use economies of scale. Now, the market seems to have not given them any benefit for the economies of scale that has come up and the extra resources that they will be able to look for within the boundaries of these two projects. So this is the benefit that I think the market has missed out on. This will be one of the biggest gold projects in Canada. And my first pass thinking is that at 175 million market capitalization and looking at the old PEA and what might be the new PEA tells me that this company might have a nice, decent upside. Similarly, there's another company called Artemis Gold. The ticker is ARTG. It's trading at $5.50 Canadian. They have a huge market capitalization, $800 million. So maybe there is a less limited upside left in that company. But again, if you look closely at what they have achieved with just basic redrawing of the design of the project, they were able to generate massive amount of value in the market in a mere few days after they had acquired the project. Hundreds of millions of dollar worth of new value in market capitalization terms. But I think there's still upside left. There's another company that I met called Prime Mining. Again, all these companies I have never really looked at in any details in the past, but I'm going to spend more time. But my first pass impression has been extremely good. Prime Mining has very, very good oxidized ore grade in Mexico. It is trading at $500,000, and I think the company is headed for a multi-million ounce deposit. And if this continues to be oxidized grade, which will give them fabulous recoveries, I mean, this can be a very, very profitable project. A lot of people worry that 1.3 might not be a high enough grade, but it might not be a high enough grade for fresh rock, for oxidized grade. This is an extreme, this can become an extremely profitable project. I have a lot more names, Shad and Corey.
Well, I'm sure we'll touch on some of those in future interviews, but now I do want to move it over to the uranium sector, because that has been the standout, outperforming resource sector, especially when it comes to the stocks. That's been the one real, in a way, surprising aspect, is that now, finally, the uranium price is starting to play catch-up, but these stocks have been on a run for months now. Look, there's a number of different stories that we can get to within uranium that is causing this rise in the uranium price. But what's your takeaway from the run that we have seen in what is a relatively small resource sector, uranium?
Well, I don't get excited about this feeding frenzy when this happens. My tendency is to sell and get out of that market. But in fact, I have never been too excited about the uranium sector. There is a lot of greed and lust in the market, which makes people think that they can understand and foresee the future of uranium market better than what buyers can see. Now, if buyers were buying uranium for $30, $35 a pound, which is actually a very small part of their total cost structure, and if they knew that they would be facing deficit of uranium in the future, why would they not have gone into long-term contracts early enough? And the reason long-term contracts haven't really gone up much and they weren't too high in the past was because buyers themselves probably see enough uranium coming their way at a reasonably good price. So these retail investors, people who don't really understand the nitty-gritty of the uranium sector, think that they can foresee the future better, but they are mostly driven not by mathematical skills or proper analysis, but mostly driven by greed and lust. And I want to stay away from market where greed is dominating the sector.
Well, Giant, there's a lot of people that have opined on this, whether it's on Twitter or whether it's people that bring on the uranium mining company CEOs, and or even people that are some of the people that actually follow, like the UEX and like the people that do the pricing, which is very opaque in the uranium industry. And they said that there's a disconnect in the utility companies thinking that there was a lot more supply versus the reality that there really wasn't as much supply, and it's hard to bring these uranium mines back online. So it looks like the narrative has been a lot of people fed these miners to higher levels and bid them up because they believe that that contracting cycle is about to start and that it would need to be in the 50s or 60s for these companies to actually incentivize new production. So some of this is in people's minds front running that eventuality that will, and on top of that, all the buying that there's been in the spot market mopping that up. So what do you think of that narrative that maybe the utility companies are a little bit behind the eight ball and they're going to have to come to the table with the mining companies, and that's what's behind some of this move?
Oh, that is entirely possible, Shad. But I talk with a lot of traders in commodities, and they often tell me that they, when they do contracts, they actually, when they buy and sell as mediators, they do future selling when they buy something at spot right away. They don't wait for any time at all. So when the real buyers, the real suppliers, and the real traders can't predict the price, who am I as an outsider in the uranium buying and selling supply chain to think that I know better than the buyers and suppliers. Now, I'm not saying that uranium prices won't go up. Maybe it can go up to $100 a pound, and it did go up to 150 pounds or something a decade back, which in real time terms is now worth maybe about $200 a pound. So yes, uranium price can go up to a lot of a lot higher, and it is entirely possible for uranium using companies to pay a lot more money because cost of uranium is a minor part of their demand cost structure. But at the same time, you must remember that a lot of uranium projects have been stalled and they can come online very quickly if the price sustained pricing, long-term spot prices actually do go up. But you must also remember that a lot of countries are actually closing down their uranium projects. If you look at how much uranium production has grown over the last few decades, you realize that in terms of electricity generation, uranium-based production of electricity has mostly been stagnant. It has fallen for virtually every country as a percentage of their total electricity production. So all this euphoria about uranium is ill-founded. People don't really understand that, yes, uranium electricity-producing plants are cheap to run, but they are extremely, extremely, extremely expensive to build. And the liabilities associated with running a uranium plant are either huge or negated by regulations, which are both anti-free market things. And people don't really understand that fully. But again, when you are greedy, you ignore what your greed does not like.
Yeah, you raised some good points there, Giant. And I think it's still about 20% of the U.S. electric grid and about 15% of the global grid. But you bring up a good point that if the price does rise, let's say it gets to 50 or 60, which is the incentive price to bring on new production, and that production comes online, where's the upside from there? So one other question, though. A lot of people focus on the spot market, and really that's not what moves the dial for the producers. It's the contracts. But in the spot market, the big news of the last really month has been the Sprott Uranium Trust taking over the Uranium Participation Corp, and they've been going in and buying with both hands in the spot market, mopping up that, you know, supply that a lot of hedge funds would use or that some uranium buyers would use to then sell to utilities. Do you think that that continued bid from the Sprott Trust and even from some of the non-producing companies, about a half dozen have also bought in the open markets, do you think that that will continue to have any effect, or is that more of a flash in the pan news of the day?
Well, I think I would consider that to be a flash in the pan news of the day. Remember, those people who are supposed to be buyers have to keep buying if their stock prices trade at a premium to what they own within their portfolio. So, this is the problem with division of labor. This is what they do, and they want to think, and they want to make other people think that the future is euphoric for uranium. But at the same time, when the time comes for them to sell uranium in the market, remember, market will have that extra supply, and that will be a problem for the price of uranium. So, you know, this can turn around and hurt you in the future. I don't go by what these, Sprott Uranium or UPC does. A lot of people I have seen, they don't really, they are not users of uranium, and they are very likely to make a mistake in their projections, particularly when their job requires them to expect higher price of uranium. So their incentive is to believe that uranium prices will go up. I don't want to play that game. I just want to play safe so that I can stay in the market in the long run.
All right. Hey, Giant, I see eye to eye with you in terms of a lot of this run in uranium. You know what? The stocks have run really nicely, and there has been some big buyers step into the market, but you're right. Those buyers need to stay in the market, and they need to keep on buying if we want price to keep on going. So we'll see where it all goes, but at least it has been a good sector for resource investors, because a lot of other sectors, we keep on hearing just how on sale those stocks are. Uranium stocks, at least it's been a different story. It's more fun in a bull market when stocks are going up, right? Giant, we're going to wrap it up here. It's always great chatting with you, buddy. Thank you for taking the first two segments of this weekend show. We'll chat again in another few weeks. I hope you have a great weekend.
Thank you very much, Corey and Chad.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Well, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And we are continuing our focus on the precious metals sector. In this segment, we are replaying a daily editorial that we posted on Tuesday. This is with Christopher Aaron. He runs iGold Advisors, also the senior editor for Gold Eagle. We're going to dive into some of the technicals that Christopher is watching for gold and silver, and also balance that out with U.S. market commentary and how the precious metals could relate to the U.S. equity markets. I hope you all enjoy this interview. Hey, everyone. Welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, Shad and I are chatting again with Christopher Aaron, founder of iGold Advisors and senior editor for GoldEagle.com. Now, one other thing I want Christopher just to quickly talk about here is new service that he is offering for subscribers. It is called the Elite Private Placement. So this is where Christopher goes out there, negotiates his own deals with exploration and general metals companies, and then shares those with some of the people he is working with. Christopher, give us a little bit more insights on why you started up Elite Private Placements and some more details of what people can learn about the service, please.
Thank you so much, Corey, for having me back on the show. And we will be talking about gold and silver and the Dow to gold ratio here coming up for a moment. But I appreciate the chance to just speak for 1 second about what I'm doing personally and what I'm offering. It's been my experience over the last few years that when investing in mining companies, the upside that you can achieve is incredibly enhanced when you're able to invest by these private placements. And the reason is, if you're going to buy the same amount of shares, let's say on the open market or by private placement, you almost always get free warrants with your purchase by private placement. And warrants are like options. So they give you the right, but not the obligation, to buy more shares in the future in the same company. And what that effectively does is, if the company does well, you get to nearly double your upside in the company. So when you're right on a 10 bagger, let's say, it becomes a 20 bagger. And if you're wrong, let's say the company moves sideways or declines by a little bit, there's no additional cost to you compared to if you were buying in the open market. So this is what I'm doing personally. We go out, we negotiate with the companies. We have a great group of investors already working with us. And the more investors that we have coming together, I can basically walk in to the meetings with these mining companies and say, hey, you know, we're raising $1 million or $2 million for you. We're not going to accept a half warrant at 2 years. We want a full warrant good for 3 years, so we all profit more together.
Hey, fair enough. I do a lot of my investing through private placements, and you're right. Using that warrant as extra leverage, it can help out, especially, well, it all depends on where the stock goes. But again, warrants always can help out. Let's get into what the charts are telling you then about the precious metals, starting with gold. Look, gold continues arguably to be in this downtrend. Gold's really been stuck around 1800 for about 2.5, almost 3 months now. And there is still that bearish, maybe short-term outlook and bullish longer-term outlook. 1675 continues to be a key number for investors to watch on the downside. What are you seeing within the charts?
Yeah, so gold has a little bit of an uninspiring chart here over the short term. To reemphasize, we're talking short term. It's important for investors to remember that there are strategies to make money in any market, including a market that maybe is just going to move sideways for the next 6, 12, or 18 months, which is exactly what I see happening to gold. It looks to me like gold is going to be caught in a what could be quite a giant range trade between, let's say, the 1600s and the low 1900s. This could extend well into 2022, for example. You know, I am looking at a number of rising trends that will exert influence as to buying pressure, but those groups of buyers that had been coming in at higher and higher intervals, those groups will not be emerging until a little bit later in time. You know, so you're talking about a slightly uninspiring gold chart. I don't think gold is going to collapse. I don't see it going back to $1,000, but I also think it needs to really bide its time here for perhaps the next 6 to 12 months or so, plus or minus $150 on either side of where we are right now.
Well, Christopher, just to help folks that may not be familiar with your work get up to speed on how you view the charts, when you're looking at these longer term trends, are you looking at just previous peaks and troughs of like lateral support? Are you looking at moving averages, trend lines? What are some of the things that go into how you view the longer term charts? And are you looking at these on the weekly or monthly charts, or do you look for turns on the daily? Just maybe share some of how you approach the markets with folks.
Yeah, my strategy, Shad, has been refined through trial and error over the last 20 years that I've been following the financial markets. And in my career, first of all, I'm going to say as a caveat, the bottom line is use whatever works. If another system works better for you or anyone out there listening, you use what works. You use whatever advantage you can get in the markets to stack the odds in your favor. What I have learned for myself that allows me to stack the odds in my favor is I actually don't use moving averages at all. I don't use any of the what you would call derivative types of technical indicators such as RSI, MACD, Bollinger Bands. All of those indicators are derivatives of the price. They are calculated based on the underlying price. So what I focus on basically exclusively is a study of simply the price itself. And I look for trends in the price. I look for horizontal support and resistance. What are those pivot zones? You know, you just mentioned this zone around 1675. We've had three clear bounces at 1675 over the last year. And so that is obviously a very important zone of support here. But as far as what I focus on mostly, it's really, there was a famous technician that once said, price and price alone. That's kind of what I bullet down to.
Now, Christopher, one thing that I really want you to outline here, because we talked off mic about your technical outlook for quite a while, is fine. If, let's say, gold grinds lower for 6 or even 18 months, you think, though, that the way that it relates to the Dow, so the Dow gold ratio, that could actually decline as well. Take us through your outlook here, please.
Yeah, this is totally huge, Corey. So what we're talking about here, the Dow to gold ratio, remember, when this ratio is rising, when we're talking about a higher number, we are talking about the Dow or general stocks gaining versus gold. And when the number is lower, when it's falling, that is good for gold. That means that gold is gaining versus the Dow. And so when we're talking right now here on the late at night on the 13th of September, we're talking about the Dow to gold ratio just below 20. In other words, it takes 20 ounces of gold to buy one share in the entire Dow Jones Industrial Average. So we're at 20 right now. There is a very clear downward trend that started back in the year, this is hard to imagine, but back in the year 1999, when the ratio hit its all-time high. I'm talking all-time, 1999, think about this. This was the NASDAQ bubble, the dot-com bubble, when, you know, pets.com and fill-in-the-blank.com were selling for billions and billions of dollars, you know, with no revenue, no earnings whatsoever. That was the highest ratio in the Dow to gold ever witnessed in the history of mankind. And that ratio was roughly 44 ounces of gold to buy one share in the Dow, again, back in 1999. Since that point, you look at some of the subsequent peaks in the Dow, for example, in 2001, where the ratio peaked around 40, and then you continue on through 2002 into some of the lows in the last cycle where gold hit almost $1,900 per ounce in the year 2011. And you come back up into some of the subsequent peaks in 2018. And these peaks going all the way back from 1999 are forming an incredibly clear trend of lower and lower peaks. And right now, where we are in this ratio, just below 20, is matching precisely with that trend going all the way back from 1999. And the rule in technical analysis is the trend is valid until proven otherwise. And so what it looks like is about to happen here is that the Dow to gold ratio is, it's really struggling. You can actually see this. It's struggling to rise in favor of the Dow. And what it looks like is going to happen is that the Dow to gold ratio is going to start, I'm not talking immediately, I'm not talking this week, or it doesn't even have to be this month. But at some point here, you know, throughout the remainder of the year, perhaps even into the first quarter of 2022, the Dow to gold ratio in this very strong long-term model is set to decline at least, and this is just for starters, at least back down to the 12 to 13 area, you know, which would represent, this could manifest in a couple of different ways. This could be gold moving sideways and the Dow Jones Industrial Average losing 35 to 45% of its value. Or this could be the Dow moving sideways and gold gaining by 50 to 60%. Or it could be both declining at the same time, but gold declining by a lot less than the Dow. So one way or another, we are at a window here where although when you look at gold in isolation, it's somewhat uninspiring over the next 6 to 18 months, the bigger picture relationship between these asset classes is showing me that now and into 2022, 2023, gold is going to outperform general equities. And I think investors should be really considering this, even if the nominal price of gold itself doesn't catch headlines over the very short run.
Well, just two quick questions, Christopher. There's some people that still believe that we may see a one-to-one ratio in the future. So question one is, do you think that's possible? But on the more mundane level of just price action and gold, what are you looking for in a bottoming scenario to know that, hey, we finally have arrived and, you know, it's basing? And then what do you think the trajectory would be for an uptrend from that point in time?
The first question, it is totally possible that the ratio hits one to one again. This has happened not only once, but twice in history. You know, the last time was the year 1980, in which gold and the Dow both briefly hit 850 at the same time in January of 1980. The time before that was in 1933, right in the middle of the Great Depression, when the President of the United States, Roosevelt, revalued gold from just over $20 to $35 per ounce. And at the same time, the Dow was, it wasn't quite 35. It bottomed to right around 40 in the year 1933. But functionally speaking, it was very close, 35 to 40, very close to that one-to-one. I do think it is possible. I do think that it will, in fact, happen again. The only question is it going to be in this cycle, which we could call, let's say, for example, this decade, or is there more of a mania to come in stocks first? And then, you know, perhaps could it be even in the next cycle that we again hit that one to one? The second part of the question, what am I going to be looking for to tell me that the Dow to gold is indeed, let's say, headed to one to one, or conversely, are we headed toward an outright mania, a bubble, you know, a tulip type of mania in the stock market? It's going to be what happens here at the 20 at the 20 level. Right now, the Dow to Gold has closed at 19.43. The resistance zone that I'm looking at, that trend going back to 1999, comes in really smack at right around 20.5. So there's about a 1-point buffer room. And like I said, these things can take a few months to play out here. So I would like to give it a little time, a little buffer. I think if we are breaking through 20.5, especially if we exceed 21, let's say, on the Dow to Gold, and then we're consolidating up there, I would say, wow, the general equity markets are going to reach a mania proportion similar to the NASDAQ bubble at some point by the middle part of this decade. If, however, we start to roll over, and we're not talking about 19.4 like we are right now, but let's say we start to roll over here into the first quarter of 2022, and all of a sudden we're talking about Dow to Gold at 19, 18, 17, I think this thing is coming immediately back down to 12 is the next support zone. We take it one step at a time. If we see a clear break through 12, this thing is coming at least back to 6, which was the peak from the 2011 peak in gold. If we break through 6, we're coming back to 1. So I kind of like to leave it as an if-then statement, like in computer programming. Right now, we have to focus on the 20 to 21 resistance zone, rounding down, and then let's see what happens later next year when we come back to 12.
Very interesting, Christopher. We'll keep an eye on that Dow to Gold ratio and see some of those levels because, yeah, who knows which way it's actually going to go in terms of maybe gold outperforming to the upside or just not outperforming to the downside. But hey, could be something. Everyone is waiting for that U.S. market weakness. Let's get a quick comment on silver. Silver is more than gold been trading just in a range, not so much in a downtrend, right between, let's say, like $22 to about $30. What's your outlook for silver here? Is it also going to be weak, kind of like gold?
Yeah, my outlook for silver is actually, unfortunately, you know, and I say this as someone who tries to approach the market with as little of a bias as possible. Obviously, no one has zero bias whatsoever. I mean, I operate a service that's geared toward precious metals. I wish I could say that silver is about to shoot to $50 an ounce, you know, this year, next year. Unfortunately, it looks to me as if silver is going to be relatively weaker than gold for the next 6 to 12 months or so. And I'm looking at the possibility. We have this initial support on silver at the 2150 level, the recent lows from the last consolidation that we've seen over the last year. I'm looking at the possibility that that may in fact fail, and perhaps silver is going to work its way back down toward the $18 to $19 range. Now, what I would say for investors is, although that's what I'm going to give, I'm not going to mince my words. I think that's my highest probability for silver based on the technical outlook that I specialize in. So my highest probability is for silver to come back down at least to 2150, if not to 1850. However, I think that is going to be the buying opportunity for the next decade, literally for the next decade. When we look at what happened from silver from 2011, the peak just below the $50 mark, down to the actual bottom of the bear market, which was at the coronavirus lows, just below $12. So call that a 9-year bear market. So we're only a year and a half into what could be a new bull market, which I do believe it is. That said, the entire last 5 years of the bear market had very strong resistance at that $18.50 to $19 mark. And so if the price of silver comes back to retest that former resistance, all it constitutes from a technical sense is a retest of a former resistance zone. This is very typical and, in fact, very healthy price action for a long-term bull market. And I think if we get, you know, so wherever it bottoms, if it bottoms at 2150, if it bottoms at 1850 or 19, look, it's within a couple dollars range in the big picture of things. I think the next move for silver after that happens is to break above 30. And I don't think it will go straight to 50. I think we're going to be looking at a two steps forward, one step backward kind of process. But I think the low that's coming into most likely mid-2022 is going to be the last chance to buy silver in the teens, possibly for the rest of our lives collectively.
I know, Christopher, you still follow some different stocks in the sector, shifting over to the mining stocks. We had talked about a couple off mic. Is there one that you'd like to mention here just because people always like to hear about some of the different mining companies that people have their eye on?
Yeah, let me just tell you guys what's on my radar screen right now. And of course, I own shares in this company, as do a lot of our investors here in this service. However, a company that I'm really constructive on at this moment is called Provenance Gold Corp. And this is a Canadian company that has its assets in Nevada in the United States. The ticker for Provenance Gold Corp is PAU on the Canadian and PVGDF on the US OTC. The reason why I'm really constructive on this company is they have just begun a drilling program at their White Rock property in Nevada. And the first three drill intercepts are all encountering mineralization above 0.6 grams per ton gold, which is a mineable grade for gold in Nevada. A lot of times people in this industry are attracted to these high-grade intercepts, you know, 5 grams per ton, 10 grams per ton gold. The problem is oftentimes that type of gold is like 3 miles below the Earth's surface and requires $500 million to build tunnels and extensive excavation below the Earth's surface. Provenance thus far has 3 out of 25 drill intercepts that have been reported that are all near surface open pit mineralization. The company has a market cap of only $7 million in the US. So look, guys, there's always risk in any investment. Don't get me wrong. However, when you have a company that's less than a $10 million market cap and they're already finding mineable grades of gold, the potential is something like a 10x. And I would say risk is much more moderate in the big picture of things. So that is a company that is very closely on my radar screen, Provenance Gold, PAU on the Canadian and PVGDF on the US OTC.
All right, Christopher, thanks for sharing that company. And full disclosure, I don't really know much about that company, but I'm going to do some digging here and we'll even reach out to them, bring them back on the show or bring them on the show. If anybody knows anything about the company or wants to share any information, hey, please email us, fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. Christopher, it's always great chatting with you, buddy. Again, I'll post a link to the iGold Advisor website and we'll follow up with you in probably a few weeks to get an update if any of these technicals change for gold and silver.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. Chad and I are chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex. Also writes the Mark to Market blog, which I will include in the weekend show posting, at least a link to that website. Now, we are going to cover with Mark a bit more of a general conversation, recapping some of the data that we saw this week and some of the more interesting moves in metals and even in the markets, plus look ahead to next week, which is a big week for central banks around the world because there are about a dozen meetings that are coming up next week. Mark, let's start off with this week and kind of the key data point that seemed to move markets or at least move metals was the retail sales number. Came in on Thursday, came in strong. As we know, everybody looks at this data and really they use this data to estimate or predict what the Fed might do. Give us your little summary, please, of this retail sales number, how it came in and how you think the market and traders took it.
Yeah, no, thanks. I think that the first thing is really the context. We had a soft employment report on September 3rd, and then to begin this past week, we had a soft CPI. Some people began getting cold feet about what the Fed was going to do coming up, thinking that maybe they wouldn't taper after all. And then we had that monster retail sales report. You know, most people, most economists, were looking for the fourth month's decline. And instead, it comes in much stronger than expected. Even when you exclude, we knew that auto sales were weak, but when those were excluded as well, you had a very strong number. And then there's a control function, which is economists to calculate GDP will get data from the retail sales report, but they will exclude, because they'll pick it up elsewhere, auto sales, gasoline sales, food services, building materials. That core measure also exploded. And so what this means is that despite the softest unemployment, despite the higher inflation numbers we're getting, American consumer is alive and well. And it helped perhaps by return to school season, perhaps also the child tax credit checks began going out. These things helped retail sales, but also shot up U.S. interest rates and helped lift the dollar. I think the market took away from the retail sales report that come next week, the Federal Reserve is going to take another step towards clarifying its tapering before the end of the year. That is, the Federal Reserve reduce its bond buying before the end of the year.
Well, Mark, another question I had for you is, you know, we've seen some weaker markets recently, even before these data points came out on Thursday. Do you think any of this has to do with that seasonality factor where September is usually one of the months that the general market struggles? There's also the sell Rosh Hashanah, buy Yom Kippur trade. And then we also have the quad witching options expiration today. So there's just so many seasonal factors as well as all those data points. Do you think that some of that just speaks to the market weakness we've seen the last 2 weeks? And could that change going into next week where we have most of that data behind us, except all eyes are now on the Fed?
Yeah, I think you raise a good point. You know, I see a lot of commentary talking about the last time the U.S. stock market pulled back by 5%, or how long it's been since we had a 10% pullback. And so I think the market was cautious. I think we've seen some profit-taking, people taking some chips off the table. I do think that this is like a corrective phase, and I think that people are looking to buy the dip, but the dip might not be over yet. I'm thinking maybe along the same lines you are, that we ahead of the Federal Reserve could be a hawkish statement. Why like play ahead of that? But I wonder if a lot of it would be priced in, so that by the time we get to the FOMC meeting in the middle of next week, the hawkishness has been discounted, and now we could be, the market then would be vulnerable to like a sell the rumor on the stocks, buy the fact. So that's what I'm looking to do. Is I have some names of companies that I think high value names pulling back here, and I'll look to try to put some new money to work towards the middle of next week.
Okay, so one thing to note, the S&P has pulled back pretty much right to that 50-day moving average, and that 50-day moving average has been very strong support moving back about 6 months here. So let's see how it reacts to that. Now, Mark, you said there's a couple stocks that are on your radar that have pulled back that you think could be a good investment opportunity. Are these in a general sector that you think could be first to rebound, or are you going to be looking at any individual sectors within the markets to give you some foresight into if these markets are going to bounce or if they're going to break down further?
Yeah, so what I'm looking at is, you know, part of the reason I think we are pulling back is for the economic rationale, and why we've seen some soft economic data, including some data that's not tracked by the government, but still the market follows it, like open table reservations, air traffic, clearance through the TSA in the U.S. And so we have seen a pullback. And so I'm looking at consumer discretionary sectors, and I'm also looking at CapEx, because I think that that's how companies are going to make up for this higher wage costs, higher input costs, is increased productivity. And increased productivity often means more capital investment.
That's an interesting take on it. Well, Mark, off mic, you had mentioned to us that moving into next week, there's also quite a few other central banks that have data points coming out besides the Fed. Maybe walk our audience through just all the different news blips that we're going to see next week.
So maybe sticking with the major countries, we've got the Bank of Japan is going to be meeting right around the same time as the Fed. There's nothing really the Bank of Japan can do. I mean, their balance sheet, the central bank's balance sheet, is about 200% of GDP. Debt levels in Japan are very high. I'm sorry, the balance sheet is a bit more than 100% of GDP, not 200%. But there's not much they can do. And there's a leadership election, a leadership contest for the LDP. And it looks like what we should be expecting from Japan is not so much on monetary policy, but a large fiscal stimulus package. By large, I mean, they'll say it's about 30 trillion yen, which is about $270 billion. So fiscal stimulus over monetary stimulus in Japan. I'd say an interesting central bank that's not on a lot of people's radar screens is Norway. And Norway is an interesting country because their interest rate before the pandemic was at 1.5%. They did the right thing. They slashed to zero for the pandemic. But now, even though the economy is not going gangbusters, it has begun expanding again. And Norway is prudent. They say, why should we keep interest rates at zero when it's not an emergency anymore? We still might not be as strong as we were, but it's not an emergency. So they are likely to be the first high-income country to raise interest rates. So Norway is important because, you know, we all know that the central banks eased aggressively and that it's like a whole curve, like a wave, is turning higher. And it's where different countries are in that sequence. Norway is just like the queen bee in the swarm. Not that other countries will follow it, because Norway is doing it, but more because this is just a trend that's taking place. After Norway, another central bank that meets next week will be interesting is the Bank of England. They've been sounding hawkish lately, and they had a high CPI report. And what the market has done is they're pricing in 2 rate hikes for next year. So the Bank of England is not going to do anything the coming week, partly because they have an income support program for labor called the furlough system, where the government subsidizes wages for people who can't get to the office because of COVID. And this program ends later this month. So really until this program ends, the Bank of England can't have a clean view on the sort of state of the labor market. I wonder, too, if maybe the market might be getting a little bit ahead of itself and expecting 2 rate hikes. You know, usually these major central banks, they move in 25 basis points at a time. But what happened during the crisis, the Bank of England's last move was 15 basis points. And so that brought them down to 10 basis points as their base rate. So the market's pricing in a 15 basis point hike and then a 25 basis point hike beginning roughly around the middle of next year. I can't imagine the Bank of England signaling that this is not aggressive enough. Partly because not just that monetary policy can't get too far ahead of itself, but remember what's happening is that there's another lever that governments are playing, and that's fiscal policy. And next month, the UK will announce its budget, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer is going to be announcing an austere budget. That is a fiscal tightness at the same time as monetary tightness. It could be problematic. So I think that one hike next year seems prudent, and that the Bank of England will caution about getting too far, like leaning too much ahead of our skis. Those are the Swiss National Bank meets as well, and so does the Swedish Riksbank, but neither one of those banks is likely to do anything anytime soon. In the emerging markets, I'd say, there's about 6 emerging market central banks that meet. Most of the emerging market countries seem to be biased towards raising interest rates. Turkey will stand out as a country that looks like they're going to cut interest rates next week. The Turkish lira is one of the weakest currencies, but it is true that Turkey is sort of an outlier. You know, their repo rate is at 19%, partly because the inflation is roughly around the same level. And what the central bank has indicated is they're going to look more at the core rate, which will allow them to cut interest rates, and the Turkish lira is being punished for this.
Mark, do you think any of these moves by other central banks have any impact on what the Fed does? Or is the Fed simply looking at U.S. data and U.S. markets to make their own decisions?
Yes, I think the Fed sort of operates on its own. But when I talk to U.S. officials, central bank officials, treasury officials, I think that they put extra weight on 2 areas, the Eurozone and Japan. So I don't think the Federal Reserve really cares that much whether the Bank of Canada is tapering or whether the Norway Central Bank is going to raise interest rates. For them, I think that it's really about where the bulk of the market is, and it's dollar euro and dollar yen.
Mark, one other point that I just want you to touch on deals with some of the market action this week in the metals. Look, broadly, we're seeing commodities or the metal sector resources pull back outside of oil and uranium. But base metals, they're off their highs. Gold was smashed on the back of that good retail sales number. Different reasons for different pullbacks. Take us through why you think commodities broadly are under pressure.
Yeah, no, they have been, huh? It's kind of interesting, kind of timing well with China releasing metals from its strategic reserves, which we've talked about before. What catches my eye would be iron ore, for example. China has promised to reduce its steel output this year, partly for pollution and air quality types of issues. And even though steel output rose in the first half of the year, the market suspects it means that there's going to be bigger cuts here in the second half of the year. And I think in the past three weeks, that the iron ore, the Chinese futures contract, is down 25%. It's just an amazing collapse in the price of iron ore, which, of course, is used for steel. And I think that the challenge for this, trying to like think through the ramifications, it's really going to affect the terms of trade of countries that export iron ore, like Australia. This is partly, you know, China's also releasing some of its oil next week. I think they had the first oil auction. It's really when the market first heard that China was going to sell some of its oil, people got excited about it and took oil prices down. But they're only selling a little bit more than 7 million barrels. It's a lot of, it sounds like a lot, but at the end of the day, it's not even one day's worth of imports for China. I think that a lot of this is still, a lot of the metals is who's the demand for it. And China is still the world's factory. And the latest data suggests that the Chinese economy has slowed markedly, more than people thought. And so I think that the next big shift is going to have to be more stimulative actions from China, though it looks like it's very targeted. I see that we've had, like you say, other metals too. Aluminum's come off the boil a little bit. There's still strike activity in South America affecting copper prices. But I think that people are sort of like a bit schizophrenic, if I could say that. That on one hand, they recognize inflation pressures around the world, mostly elevated. But at the same time, they're worried that central banks tightening, even tapering, is going to choke off the recovery. I'm not convinced that that's true. I think that it's sort of sequentially, first they'll deal with the inflation, and then later policy can move to be more stimulative if needed. It's really more on fiscal policy for stimulus now rather than monetary policy. Other countries are also doing, also it looks like they're going to be doing more infrastructure. In the long run, this is probably good. But I think, again, what we're going to see is other materials, green. I see more and more emphasis on green production, green infrastructure. And so this has to be taken into account, too, I think.
Yeah, Mark, that's exactly kind of where I was going to ask you is like, how do you balance out some of these infrastructure bills, not just in the U.S., but in other countries with this narrative that, you know, the inflation is transitory and we had the softer CPI number? Do you think a lot of this commodity weakness, besides the China effect, which is clear, could be the inflation discussion and that people think, hey, maybe inflation was transitory?
It could. I mean, I'm sort of concerned that what happens is that what parts of inflation are transitory? My barber hasn't changed his price, and he doesn't have to compete with China or third world countries. So I think a lot of services prices might be sticky, and what will happen is as consumers shift from buying goods to buying services, we'll see that impact on prices as well. You know, what I'm watching too is that a lot of companies know that the investors, the institutional investors, put more weight on their own like internal measure of ESG ratings. And so what I see happening is as these companies, as the industrial metals type companies step up output, we're seeing that the carbon offsets, you know, people trade these carbon offsets And these are also very expensive right now. And I think that we need to take into these kinds of things into account. Like we've seen like this huge rally in natural gas. And it doesn't seem to be so much China, though China does seem to be rebuilding, which they typically do in the second half of the year, but where the energy costs have really been punishing is in Europe. And I think to your point, Chad, Europe's wrestling with this too. On one hand, the households' electric bills, partly because a lot of it's natural gas, droughts have also hurt hydroelectric power. That by hurting, I mean raising the price of hydroelectric power. And so what several European countries are doing, Italy, France, Spain, Greece, they're giving subsidies or tax breaks to households, which it's basically like they're giving tax breaks incentives to consume more energy at exactly the wrong time. That is right, as we try to move toward a green area, this could have been a way that, like we're doing in the U.S., we're not getting people a tax break for higher gasoline prices or higher what it's going to cost to heat homes. But in Europe, they're really giving this these subsidies, these tax breaks. And this is, I think, one way that just we're seeing different countries wrestle with trying to, like, with that conflicting priority. They don't want to squeeze the households. The households are just coming back from this pandemic shock. And now they got this energy shock. But yet we're concerned about the long-term future here. And so I think that different countries are making different choices here that do affect the prices.
All right, Mark, great chatting with you as always, buddy. There was actually a fair bit to talk about this week and some weakness broadly in a wide range of markets. Let's see how it all plays out next week as all attention shifts to central banks around the world and the Fed, although the expectation for this meeting for the Fed won't be much change. Mark, thanks as always for taking time with us. Great having you back on the show. Great hearing your thoughts. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And everybody who tuned in, thank you for listening to this first hour. The second hour is going to be a replay of a lot of the important company updates that we recorded from this week, as Al is taking a little break this week. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Good luck, everybody.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.